Hey there, this is Laura Kanoy.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh.
Oh, got it. If you love the exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for the exchange.
This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Candidates and their supporters began lining up at the Secretary of State's office this week, eager to file for fall elections. And this year, garnering the most attention is the U.S. Senate race, pitting incumbent Senator Kelly Ayotte against Governor Maggie Hassan. Ayotte filed promptly on the first official day, and she wasted no time in challenging the governor's lack of experience in foreign policy.
You already have examples of where Governor Hassan hasn't had the same level of depth of understanding of the threats that we face and how to address them. And so I look forward to a vigorous debate with her about how do we keep this country safe.
However, before facing Hassan in the general election, Ayotte has a primary race to win. Former Republican State Senator Jim Rubens filed on the same day. He explained his strategy as he made his way to the Secretary of State's office.
We've got two candidates, Hassan and Ayotte, who are both systemically ducking the major issues. They're almost identical to one another in positions, so I'm providing an option, an alternative for voters, for a candidate who is willing to confront these major issues.
And 1,000 bills later, New Hampshire lawmakers wrapped up their legislative session this week. Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley reflected on their accomplishments.
Medicaid expansion, combating the heroin crisis, and then, you know, closed off today with more business tax relief. So I feel like we've had a very productive, largely bipartisan session.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Hi, Gary.
How are you, Laura?
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
And joining us now as we look at politics in our first segment is John DeStazo. He's a political reporter at WMUR-TV. And John, thanks for taking time out.
Morning, Laura. Thank you.
Well, this week, guys, candidates for federal and state office began lining up at the State House. A lot of pomp and circumstance as the filing period opened on Wednesday. Gary, who made it official this week?
Well, we had quite a few, actually. The first day was pretty well mobbed at the Secretary of State's office. They were lined up in the hallways a couple of times. Well, the first person to file was actually Congressman Frank Ginta, although he didn't file in person. He had an aide file for him. And then we had the U.S. Senate candidates. Kelly Ayotte, the incumbent, was first in for the candidates for that. And then right behind her was her challenger in the Republican primary, Jim Rubens. We also had a couple of candidates for the second congressional district file as well. Jack Flanagan, Annie Custer, Andy Martin, I think, is another one who is filing. Ashew is in, I think, today. Skip Ashew. Bunch of Democrats filed an entire slate for state Democratic state Senate races, for pretty much. And we've had a whole bunch of executive counselors in are ready to file.
Wow. And that's just in the first,
two or three
days. So John DeStazo, by the way, okay, so Gary said that candidates for state Senate were there. Do candidates for state House have to file with the Secretary of State as well? Because that would be a lot of people in the halls.
Yeah, I sure would. And that's probably one of the reasons that state representatives do not have to go to the Secretary of State's office. They file at their town or city clerk. Normal business hours, as it says on the Secretary of State's website, and all the clerk's offices in the state need to be open on the final day, June 10th, all the way to 5 o'clock. So that's where state representative candidates need to go, to their local town or city halls.
Well, and I want to ask all of you about something that Gary mentioned, and that is that, you know, while all the attention has been on this Kelly Ayotte, Maggie Hassan race, Senator Ayotte does have a Republican challenger in the primary, Jim Rubens, well known among political circles here in New Hampshire. NHPR spoke to Jim Rubens as he was heading in to file. Here's what he said about grabbing that outsider mantle. That's his goal.
Was Bernie Sanders a protest candidate here in New Hampshire? Darn right. And he won in a landslide. Was Donald Trump a protest candidate here in New Hampshire? You're darn right. And he won by a landslide. The American people have discovered, and particularly here in New Hampshire, have discovered that Washington is busted.
So, John DeStazo, could Jim Rubens be the state version of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump?
Well, anything is possible, certainly. He's certainly portraying himself as an outsider. If you go back into his history, I'm not sure that he's really an outsider, but he's certainly a unique candidate, a unique individual. Back, oh gosh, more than 20 years ago, he tried to build an independent new majority party in New Hampshire in 1993. He was talking at that time to folks like Arnie Arneson and John Rao. More recently,
Democrats.
He had been a consultant at one time for the Union of Concerned Scientists and was into cap and trade. He lived in a commune at one point. He's been a leader of the anti-gambling movement in New Hampshire. Of course, he's been a state senator, successful state senator. He was a candidate for governor in 1998. And, of course, in 2014, he ran for the U.S. Senate, losing to Scott Brown in that primary. That also included Bob Smith. Now, and in 2014 and now, he's, I guess, portraying himself as a staunch conservative. And I know in 14 he had the support of a conservative group known as the Republican Liberty Caucus of New Hampshire. So Jim has been around for a long time, as we know, but certainly, I guess, as compared to the, you know, to Senator Ayotte and some of the folks who have been in Washington, he would be an outsider in that way.
Yeah, it depends on how you define outsider status. Go ahead, Dean Spiliotis. Love your thoughts.
You know, John did a great job of giving us a thumbnail sketch of Jim Rubens. Has not had a lot of success running for statewide office, although he was a state senator from the Upper Valley for I think 4 years. He lives in Aetna. It's interesting, as John knows, WMUR ran an interview with Jim Rubens over the week. I think it was last weekend. And he really aligned himself quite closely with Donald Trump, said he was an early endorser of Donald Trump, that he supported him. You know, sort of an interesting fit in terms of ideological positioning. You know, Jim has done a lot of work on climate science and climate change. Donald Trump has been sort of very sort of firmly in the traditional conservative line of not seeing it as a problem. So there'll be some interesting differences there. But, you know, it's and as John also mentioned, he's become increasingly kind of aligned with libertarians. You know, we'll see. I just think it's going to be a challenge for him to get into the conversation because so much of the narrative at this point is really about the general election race between Governor Hassan and Kelly Ayotte. But you know, he's been in this position before, and he certainly seems to be energized by undertaking these campaigns. And you know, to some extent, he can self fund. We've talked about that before if he needs to. Interesting. At least you know there will be a primary, and we'll see if he can break into the narrative.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we cover some of the top Granite State headlines of the week. Right now, we're focusing on who filed for the fall elections this week at the Secretary of State's office. 1-800-892-6477. And, gentlemen, let's go to our listeners. Steve's joining us from Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
A very simple question. Let's say I want to run for the Senate. I decided to throw my hat in the ring. What do I have to do? What qualifications in order to, I know I must go to Concord physically. Tell me what I have to do to run today for the Senate.
Now, U.S. Senate, Steve, or State Senate?
Yeah, U.S. Senate.
U.S. Senate. Okay. John DeStazo, you want to grab that one?
Well, I believe there's a filing fee, isn't there, Gary?
Yes, there is.
$1,000, I believe it is.
I believe it's $1,000. Yeah.
And either that, or you have to have a certain number. Isn't it 1,500
nomination
petitions,
papers? Yeah.
In each congressional district, in order to run in a statewide election.
If you're not going to pay the fee. Yeah.
If you're not going to pay the fee.
Yeah.
And pretty much, I think that is the major qualifications. If you're running for governor, you have to be a resident of the state for 7 years. But in terms of the state senate, I'm not sure what the residency requirement is. I think you have to obviously, I believe you have to live in the district in which you want to represent, which is not the case in the congressional races, by the way.
Yeah. Go ahead, Gary. Go ahead and jump in.
I mean,
it's a good question, Steve.
Residency
Thank you.
Really is kind of open in terms of the federal offices. I mean, you can live in one congressional district and run in another. In fact, we have Andy Martin, who lives in Manchester, running in the second district, which doesn't include Manchester.
And so our caller asked about U.S. Senate, Gary. What else would he hypothetically need to do?
I mean, ostensibly, he has to be a resident of the state. But, I mean, as we know with Scott Brown 2 years ago, I mean, he really wasn't a resident of the state until just before he ran for U.S. Senate. So,
you know, at one level, guys, this filing is just a formality. You know, like John and Gary were describing, you got to plunk down your money or show your signatures and prove that you're a resident and so forth. But at another level, Gary, you know, candidates can use this as an important political moment. What did you see on that score this week?
I mean, we just got over this with the presidential candidates. They're all lining up. And
are you feeling a little weary of this, Gary?
15 minutes of fame. Oh, no. And, I mean, we had the same thing. They bring in their supporters now. It used to be kind of quiet, you know. People would line up the first day and people would, you know, that would be the big publicity. If you got to front of the line, you got a lot of publicity.
If you were first, the headline would be so-and-so files first.
People would camp out to line up to be the first one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And now, I mean, now people bring these entire entourages with them, you know, so that when Kelly Ayotte was filing, lines were all through the state house.
It's a gauntlet of supporters that you walk through.
You need good optics for TV, John, right?
Don't forget the protesters, because
there were protesters too.
Right, just as many protesters outside in the hall. There was a shouting contest. Mm-hmm. Ayotte, of course, had a rally outside. It's a photo op. It's really a photo op. I'm not sure that outside of those of us who follow politics, anyone really cares that much. And another important aspect of it is that there's a traditional press conference after the filing where we all try to ask some pretty decent questions. I thought that we were able to evoke some good comments out of Senator Ayotte. And we'll see on Monday when the governor goes in. It'll be sort of a mirror image of, I think, of what we saw with Senator Ayotte. There will be a big crowd, both sides, and there will be a press conference, and there'll be some questions. So I think that it's a traditional thing. And, of course, yes, we saw this in the presidential primary repeating itself, especially with all these candidates, more than 20 times.
As they all came through. And Dean, John mentioned and Gary mentioned it's a photo op. There's
sure.
optics for television and so forth. In Congressman Frank Ginta's case, there was a lack of a photo op. As somebody mentioned, Frank Ginta did not show up to file. He had an aide do it. How unusual is that?
It does happen, as we are saying. Traditionally, candidates like to have this. It's a photo opportunity. It's an organizational tool now, particularly with social media. These filing, candidates filing, which was all over social media. People reaching out to their supporters to get them excited. It's kind of a kickoff to the campaign season. But sometimes for logistical reasons, they can't be here. Other times, if they want to avoid the media, they'll have somebody else do it. I don't want to say for sure why Frank Ginta. I didn't read sort of what reason he gave. Maybe Gary or John know why he wasn't there. But in theory, it could be to avoid having to deal with the scene if that's what you want to do.
Well, that was certainly what political reporters said. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, I mean, ostensibly he was at some event earlier that day that was going on about the same time. But so was Kelly Ayotte, and she ended up coming up to the file And so it wasn't like it was a huge conflict. I mean, obviously, he's had issues the last couple of years concerning his finances, his campaign finances, and another is coming out about how his lawyers tried to slow down the investigation till the election. So he probably wasn't looking forward to answering those kind of questions when he's signing up to run for Congress.
Go ahead, John. Yeah, jump in.
I was just going to say, I think he probably wouldn't have felt comfortable with mainly with the press conference. And since all of this has come up regarding his FEC problems, Federal Election Commission problems, has tried to be like workmanlike. You know, he's always doing events. He's had the opioid task force, sort of nose to the grindstone sort of thing, and trying to just win his support that way. His support is very low. Let's just face the facts that it is right now. In terms of, approval, disapproval, and Republicans many Republicans say they would never vote for him. So I think that was probably it, that, I don't need to do this politics stuff. I'm too busy, doing my work for the people. I would think that would be sort of the message he was trying to portray. Whether that works or not is another matter. We'll see.
Well, and in response to Steve from Nottingham's question about what would I have to do if I decided to run for office, in Steve's case, he said U.S. Senate. I have some information here, just in case people are wondering. For governor and U.S. Senate, you got to pay $100 or get 200 primary petitions. That's what the Secretary of State's office says. Representative in Congress, $50, 100 petitions. Executive counselor, $25, 50 petitions. State senator, $10, 20 petitions. You can see where this is going. Down to state representative, $2 or 5 primary petitions. So thanks for the information from the Secretary of State's office. I also have a couple Facebook comments from our listeners on Senator Ayotte filing this week. Caroline says, I will not vote for any incumbents. Jeffrey says, stop marching in lockstep with the Tea Party and the Donald, and you might have a small chance. Thanks to Jeffrey and Caroline for those comments. And guys, we should talk about Donald Trump, because there was a big news conference this week where Dean Spiliotis, Donald Trump really got a lot of negative press and was helped out by two New Hampshire Republican lawmakers. First of all, who were they, Dean, and what did they say?
Yeah, and I should mention on that last item that for the New Hampshire presidential primary, it is $1,000.
Okay.
So that's why we're using the $1,000 figure, and then it's obviously discounted as you go down. So backdrop to the story is, you remember a while ago, Donald Trump did not participate in a Fox News debate because he was unhappy with Megyn Kelly as a potential moderator.
This is way back,
Dean,
right?
Going back a while. Yeah, and instead he held an event and he raised money for veterans organizations. And at the time he said he raised about $6 million. And since that moment, national media have kind of been checking up on him to see whether or not this money has been dispersed, how much money had been dispersed. There have been some conflicting stories in recent weeks about whether or not groups are getting the money. Some have, some haven't. Some people suggested the figure was actually more like $4.5 million until Donald Trump kicked in an additional million. So the upshot of all this is he held a press conference on Tuesday following the big Rolling Thunder Veterans event down in Washington, D.C., the annual event around Memorial Day. He held this press conference on Tuesday. It was very testy. It said, was very aggressive with the media, just basically unhappy with the way this story has developed. And two New Hampshire supporters, State Representatives Al Baldessaro and Fred Doucette, went down there of their own volition. When Trump saw they were there, he brought them on stage. They flanked him. As he talked about these veterans donations. And then Al Baldessaro addressed the media afterwards and had a few choice words for them as well.
Well, we got a little clip of that. So let's hear New Hampshire State Representative Al Baldessaro defending Donald Trump.
They are using veterans as political pawns. It must stop. Donald Trump is doing this for the heart. You're all focused on the way he's raising money, and you're not looking at the 22 veterans that are killing each other every day. You're not concerned about the thousands of veterans that are on wait lists. Look at his plan on his Trump's website. He talks about medical cards. He talks about fixing the VA. He talks about competition. I think the liberal media, and I've been dealing with you a long time, need to get your head out of your butt, focus on the real issues.
Again, that's Al Baldacero, a state representative from Londonderry, New Hampshire, a loyal Trump supporter who has campaigned for Donald Trump in the Granite State and even subbed in occasionally as a surrogate on network news interviews. By the way, that clip was provided by C-SPAN. So John DeStazo, Dean Spiliotis, Gary Reno, we will talk more in just a moment. Stay with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. As always, you can join us, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, some last-minute surprises at the State House as the legislature wraps up its session. We'll find out more in just a minute, but I do want to finish up our coverage of politics at this point and also, again, invite our listeners to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the roundup this week are John DeStazo, political reporter at WMUR-TV, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And John, that clip we heard of Al Baldacero really blasting the media, saying they were focusing too much on whether these organizations, these veterans organizations, had received money or not, and not enough on all the problems with veterans services in the country and the real struggles that veterans have. As a longtime political reporter, John, what's important about this?
Well, what's important about it, and you were very nice to Al in the way you described what he said. He was a little more blunt. but that was Al. As we all know, we've heard him on the floor of the House sounding pretty much like that. It was kind of fun to see Al standing right next to Trump in that nationally televised press conference. But it just gives an idea of how important New Hampshire is and what the impact of the New Hampshire primary can have on a candidate and on some of the followers. I mean, here is Trump, who said that Al did not, he just kind of showed up that morning because he was upset. And if that's true, then Donald Trump let him right on stage. I don't think he would do that for people who he hasn't known for many, many months, probably more than a year since he started campaigning here. There are relationships made during the New Hampshire primary. Of course, the prime extreme example of that was George H.W. Bush naming John Sununu chief of staff. And you know, on social media, when Al was up there, there was kind of some light banter about the possibility of we might be looking at the next secretary of the VA. Who knows?
Wow. Okay.
And no, Dean, I'm exaggerating a bit, but that's sort of the idea with in terms of relationships that's
right. And we've seen this so often, right, John, in New Hampshire's past. Other New Hampshire supporters becoming, you know, key members of an administration. Dean, real quick thoughts, and then I want to turn to one last political story.
Yeah. Well, you know, the underlying issue here between the media and Trump is whether or not the Trump organization has dispersed money to these groups, or they're just doing it right now because he's being called on his claims of donating all this money. And, you know, some of the reporting shows that groups here in New Hampshire, a couple groups in New Hampshire, have received checks in February and March. A third group just got money this week. So it's kind of a mix. I mean, they were in the process of dispersing the money. But this whole press conference and media challenging of Trump's narrative, I think, has sped it up a little bit. But I like John's comments about how the primary forms these kinds of relationships that otherwise would not be there.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Christopher in Manchester, guys, who says, I found it interesting that this week Senator Martha Fuller Clark broke away from the Democratic establishment by endorsing Mark Connelly for governor and then saying she'd support Bernie Sanders at the Democratic convention. Let's take the first part of that first, Gary Reno. Mark Connelly for governor. Who is the sort of establishment lining up behind for governor, the Democratic establishment?
Well, largely lining up behind Colin Van Ostern, where most of the traditional Democrats are lining up. Mark obviously is coming from a different place. He was the head of securities here in the state for a number of years and is more of more of the progressive side of the party than Colin might be, although Colin's pretty progressive as it is. But I think it's very much Martha. Martha has always been aligned with the liberal wing of the party. And I mean, so it's not really that much of a surprise that she's lining up behind Mark, who was actually a pretty close neighbor of hers, and she's backing Bernie. She's one of the two of the eight superdelegates in New Hampshire that were not aligned with somebody. The other one, of course, is Ray Buckley, who's the chairman. So she's the vice chair of the Democratic Party. So I guess Bernie's turning establishment.
Well, and John DeStazo, I know you have to go. So last thought from you on this announcement by Martha Fuller Clark that she's backing Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, well, I know the Sanders people are thrilled about that because she is the vice chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. And so, you know, while she is sort of not in the mainstream, she is at the same time in the hierarchy of the party, and they're really going to try to push, probably unsuccessfully, but they're going to try to push to have, you know, some of these folks change. I can't possibly imagine any of the people who are lined up with Hillary Clinton changing, but based on the results of the primary, and I think California. If somehow Bernie wins California, which I guess is possible, there actually may be some additional pressure put on a few choice members of this super delegation to go with Bernie. But I think that would all depend on California.
All right. Well, John, thank you very much for giving us your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And I'm sorry I can't stay longer.
That's
thank
all
you.
Right. Next time. That's John DeStazo. He's a political reporter at WMUR-TV and a longtime observer of New Hampshire politics. You can join us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Gary and Dean, back to our listeners. Francis is calling from Bedford. Hi, Francis. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I was interested in your discussion of Kelly Ayotte and the comment she made the other day about Maggie Hassan having no foreign policy experience. That's a major concern of hers, and yet she's supporting Donald Trump, whose only foreign policy experience, according to him, was judging a Miss Universe pageant when they were in Russia. So there's some hypocrisy there coming from Kelly Ayotte, and I saw a New York Times story done in January of 14. It came across my desk the other day where Kelly Ayotte went to ski in Utah, and she went with 100 lobbyists who spent almost $1 million on her and her expenses over a one-week period back in January of 2014. So I'm a little concerned about Kelly Ayotte's honesty and integrity. I'm an independent, not a hardcore Democrat or Republican, but her comments about foreign policy, and yet she's backing Donald Trump with no foreign policy, makes me think maybe this woman is an empty suit.
Well, Francis, thanks for the call. And I actually want to pick up, guys, on the second part of his comment, saying that Kelly Ayotte had traveled out of state and questions about who had funded those trips. Gary Reno, Kelly Ayotte is now making that a case against Governor Hassan. Give us a little more there.
Well, when she signed up, she was talking about she was very concerned that the governor didn't understand the issues of national security, pointing out a couple of statements that the governor had made earlier. I mean, if you look at some of the other issues that these two kind of have been going after each other on, you know, it's an issue where obviously Hassan has no real experience. And she is going there rather than going about, well, she's not lined up behind veterans. She's not doing enough for the opioid crisis and so on. I mean, these are issues that kind of neutralized each other in these issues. This is one where obviously Kelly has more experience than the governor has.
And go ahead.
I can talk to that. Yeah, I think what you're referring to is the Ayotte campaign has gone after Governor Hassan for being out of state to raise money. I think they tweet out this figure of 30 days quite frequently. And the Hassan campaign has replied that, you know, Kelly Ayotte has missed lots of committee hearings in Congress. And so, you know, there's this back and forth. You know, this is a very common argument made against governors when they start to run for either president or statewide office, that they're suddenly focused elsewhere and not focused on the business of the state. It's funny. I recalled in 2004 when Howard Dean ran for president in neighboring Vermont, a lot of scrutiny on how much time he was spending away from Vermont. who is paying for his security detail, all of these kinds of questions. And we're hearing the same arguments thrown at Governor Hassan. On foreign policy, that's a, you know, it's a very important issue. This is something that governors deal with when they run for the U.S. Senate or for president. I mean, Kelly Ayotte was an attorney general. She didn't have foreign policy experience either, but she very quickly was schooled on foreign policy with John McCain and Lindsey Graham. I interviewed Governor Hassan a few weeks ago, and I asked her about her foreign policy concerns. And she clearly has started to do her homework on this because it is important for U.S. senator to be able to talk on these issues. She also very quickly aligned, talked about how Kelly Ayotte supports Donald Trump's foreign policy. So it's going to be a bone of contention. So those are the two issues, foreign policy and out-of-state fundraising.
Yeah, and I've seen the ads around both.
Yep.
I did want to turn, guys, to the legislative session wrapping up. The session runs 2 years, ending in the spring of an election year, and there's always some surprises at the end. Gary Reyno, you've been doing this for a long time. How about this time around? Any surprises as things wrapped up?
First of all, I'd say 2 years feels more like two decades in the past 2 years. But I think the big surprise was one of the key bills in the legislative package to deal with the opioid / heroin crisis went down to defeat. It was $1.5 million in grants for local law enforcement agencies to run programs such as Granite Hammer, which is down in Manchester, which targets street-level dealers and users and tries to work that up the ladder to the large people. It failed by one vote.
One vote?
One
wow.
vote. It was largely due to a couple of issues. There was a provision on retirement health care for state workers that was attached to it, which a lot of the Democrats didn't like. And because this was targeted to police and interdiction and arrests and so on, a lot of the libertarian free staters and the Republican Party didn't like this either. So they're going to kind of join together with enough votes to kill it by one vote.
Well, there was strong and negative reaction from those directly involved in fighting the drug crisis on hearing that the House had killed this bill. As you said, Gary, $1.5 million. To fund law enforcement programs like Operation Granite Hammer. Here's just a sampling of that reaction. Again, pretty widespread negative reaction, starting with Manchester Police Chief Nick Willard and giving credit here to WMUR-TV.
But you don't do it at the expense of American citizens who are dying every single day. I am disgusted with that maneuver. It was a political shenanigans, and it never should have happened.
That $1.5 million was a strong component. Again, another piece of the puzzle. Enforcement is a piece of that puzzle, and not having that money is hampering.
The Granite Hammer was working. We were arresting people and getting them off the streets. We were arresting the low-level drug dealers, the high-level drug dealers. That's what we need to be doing, and we need to get those funds into the system.
The lawmakers are coming back on the 16th of June, and they're going to vote on that issue, and we'll get it passed this time.
All right, and again, thanks to WMUR for that. We heard from Manchester Police Chief Nick Willard, the governor's advisor on the drug crisis, James Vera, Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis, and Senate President Chuck Morse in that montage there. And Gary, political shenanigans. So that is the idea that this unrelated measure was tied to the drug funding. That sounds like something Congress does. Does the legislature do that typically?
There was so much of that this year.
Really?
This whole issue with the retirees' health care, it's been running at a deficit, and it's that the governor's office and the lawmaker, Republican-controlled legislature have been going back and forth, back and forth. So the idea was the Republican House wanted to put this provision in that will start charging those who turn 65 for their premiums, which they don't pay now after they don't pay after 65. And this would start charging them. And that's what the Democrats didn't like. That's what the governor didn't like. And so we attach this to a bill that we know the governor wants. So she can't veto it.
This is the law enforcement money.
It's law enforcement money. So this is what they tried to do.
So it's a poison pill, basically.
Well, it's not a poison pill. It's a sort of an insulation against a veto. You know, so this will go through because she wants the money for the law enforcement.
So it didn't work. They're coming back in 2 weeks, or it worked, but temporarily. Right. They're coming back in 2 weeks to vote on this again.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of people kind of dropped the ball a little bit on this bill, too. I think most people just thought it was going to go through, including the governor, including the House leadership, even including the Senate leadership. I think everybody thought it was just going to go through, and they were kind of blindsided when they found out that there was a lot of people that weren't really happy about this.
Well, and Dean, you know, in addition to the sort of politicking around this, as Gary said, there was a larger philosophical debate here, right? I mean, the idea that you can't arrest your way out of this problem.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for some time now. There is one side of the argument is that simply pouring more money into additional law enforcement is problematic, and that there needs to be more of a shift towards focusing on treating this as an addiction rather than a crime. And I think that's sort of the two sides that you saw in the debate over this particular $1.5 million.
Well, and voting against the $1.5 million was Manchester Representative Amanda Bolden, again, reflecting this idea that focusing on law enforcement isn't the way out of this. Let's hear.
We all know that the war on drugs is a failure. And if you know that people use drugs because they are a victim of trauma, then you know that we can't cure trauma with yet more trauma.
Again, that's Manchester Representative Amanda Bolden talking about why she voted against this extra money for law enforcement. Final thoughts there, Gary, on sort of where this goes from here, especially June 16th, special session on this money.
Oh, I think we'll see it go through very quickly. The fallout's happened. People aren't happy about it. Everybody will get their ducks in line, and it will go through very quickly.
But we won't have the
retirement piece on it. It's just going to be the money for the grant.
Straight up and down. Yeah. All right. Again, the number for you to join us as we wrap up some of the top headlines around New Hampshire this week, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And just wrapping up again, this idea of money for the drug crisis, lawmakers did pass $5 million for substance abuse prevention and treatment. Monday on the exchange, we're going to be talking more about treatment and recovery. So we'll set that aside for now. Another broader issue that resonated in New Hampshire this week, guys. I'll turn to you first, Dean. The House and Senate passed a 10-day residency requirement for voting. Now, Dean, how unusual are residency requirements around the country? It's not that unusual, is it?
I'm not sure, to be honest, but I will say that in New Hampshire, certainly, it's been an ongoing issue. You may recall a while back there was a movement to try to have a 30-day residency requirement, and I think Governor Hassan vetoed that. This all gets to the issue of what the state means by domicile, and some people who oppose these kinds of requirements believe it's an attempt to suppress voter turnout. And so there was this 10-day requirement that was being legislated. Governor Hassan would likely veto it, but I believe, Gary, it was actually in the end killed in the Senate.
It was killed in the Senate.
Right.
It didn't pass the Senate.
I see. Okay, so no residency requirement.
Not now.
Not now, no. Despite all the talk, not, Gary. No. I mean,
she
Dean's right.
Anyway.
It was. I mean,
We've been around and around on this year.
The House and the Senate went around and around over the 10 or 30-day residency requirement. They settled on the 10-day, but it went 12-12 in the Senate with the two Republicans joining with the 10 Democrats to basically kill it off.
Well, and another key bill that the legislature rejected, again, after lots of around and around and around, a bill that would, as its supporters describe, enhance eminent domain protection in the event of gas pipeline development. What would this have done, Gary, if passed?
This bill would have said that if your house is within 250 feet of the pipeline and they want to put it on your property, they would have to buy the entire property. So it's basically
be very expensive.
It'd be very expensive, and it gives protection to the homeowner so that you're not going to be living next to a pipeline. There's some federal issues involved with this, and it also another one of these which gets tied up in another issue, which was what you do with the Reggie money. So there were a lot of things involved in this, and not just the eminent domain. What is interesting is this was the last bill of about a dozen.
There were a lot this year concerning pipelines.
And they all went down except this one, and now this one's gone.
Okay. Well, after a short break, NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown will join us to catch up on a couple environmental stories, including one concerning another big energy project, and that's the Northern Pass. Stay with us. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. This week, our guests are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader in Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital. And with us now also is NHPR's environment reporter, Sam Evans-Brown. He's also host of our new show, Outside In. And Sam, thanks for taking a couple minutes. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, this week, a judge dismissed a lawsuit brought by the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests against the Northern Pass Hydropower Project. What were the specifics of this suit, Sam?
So if we think back to early on when Northern Pass was first proposed, we had this sort of chess match going on between the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests and the Northern Pass, where they were both buying land. Northern Pass trying to complete a route through the North Country and the Forest Society trying to block that route. And the Forest Society thought that they had them blocked. They had, you know, sort of a wall of conservation easements between Canada and down south, basically. And the workaround that Northern Pass came up with is they said they were going to bury a portion of the line under a road, and that road ran right through a conservation easement that the Forest Society had. And basically, this lawsuit stems from that decision. They said that, hey, we own this land, we own the land under that road, and we never gave you permission to bury the power line there. And so they took Northern Pass to court, saying essentially, you know, you can't do this. However, Northern Pass cited state law saying that any transportation right-of-way has long been recognized as a viable route for electric utilities. And they cited, you know, case and verse, lots of opinions to support them. And they essentially said that this lawsuit that Spiniff had brought was a publicity stunt. The lawyer from Northern Pass pointed to the brief that the society had filed and saying, you know, they don't have any jurisprudence that they can cite that shows that we don't have the right to do this. And essentially the judge in this ruling agreed with Northern Pass. It's a summary judgment, which means that basically he went through and he said, there is no disagreement on the facts between the two parties here, and still the Forest Society loses. So it's basically saying that this suit is all hat and no cattle.
How does this fit into the larger picture of Northern Pass, which is, you know, at a pretty critical moment right now?
Well, I'd say that the fact that this suit existed in the first place basically shows that the opponents are throwing everything in the kitchen sink at Northern Pass. They're doing absolutely everything they can. They're pushing all of their options, even if they might not have a great chance at all of them. But in the grand scheme of things, it really doesn't change anything. We still are. They're going to go through the site evaluation committee process, which should be finished, you know, likely October of 2017. So we've got, you know, a year and 5 months more of hearing about this.
Well, and Sam, last question for you on this, and then I do want to cover a couple other stories with you, please. Clarify for me. I thought the Forest Society's position was, hey, if this project is going to go forward, it should be buried. The land in question, Northern Pass had said, yeah, we'll bury it. So how does this lawsuit square with that stated goal of we prefer burial?
Right. I think you're sort of alluding to some of the spin that Northern Pass had put on this lawsuit, which is essentially, the Forest Society wants burial, and here they are contesting one of the buried sections. However, I don't think that this lawsuit is really, you know, in any way hypocritical of the Forest Society, because what they've been saying is that we want the entire project buried, and therefore, since the entire project is not buried, we are going to oppose it every way that we can.
Gary, you want to jump in?
I think one of the more interesting things about this decision was that the judge made a point of saying, I'm not dealing with the public good. I'm not making any determinations about that.
Whether this is useful or not.
That's up to the site evaluation committee and state regulators. That's not up to me.
So the judge is not trying to step on that process, which is detailed, complicated, and ongoing, as Sam said, for a long time. Yeah. So another story, Sam, that I did want to follow up on with you, please. New Hampshire's ban on lead fishing tackle, designed to protect the state's loons and other waterfowl, went into effect on Wednesday. Now, I'm a little confused because I feel like we've been talking about this for a long, long, long time. When I saw the story, I thought, wait a minute, haven't we done that already?
Right. So it's one of those things that got phased in. The law itself was passed a year or two ago. So, you know, it's sort of like it blurs together in the mind for me right now. So I'm not exactly – I don't quite remember the year that it was passed. But it was phased in so sportsmen knew it was coming, but it wasn't actually in effect until now. It also came up a number of times. I mean, it was voted down the year before it actually succeeded in the legislature. So we have been debating it for a long time. And also our neighbor states have been debating it for a long time. I mean, it's the lead fishing tackle is banned in Massachusetts and Maine and Vermont. Their bans are actually a little stricter than ours. Ours is anything under an ounce, while theirs is anything under a half ounce. So, you know, even smaller stuff is banned for them. So yes, you've heard this before,
yeah.
And now it's sort of come to a conclusion.
Well, and given what we know about lead and how harmful it is to, you know, all living creatures, really, what's the debate about? I mean, we know that this is deadly to water birds.
It's about cost. I mean, the replacement tackle for the – I mean, lead is cheap and it's easy to use and it's abundant. So replacing that with bismuth or, you know, all these other types of tackle that are suggested are more expensive. And so sportsmen push back against this, you know, basically everywhere that is proposed. And we've seen other states – you know, for instance, Minnesota has lots and lots of loons, and yet the lead tackle – and never made it through in Minnesota because of opposition from sportsmen. Instead, they opted for a campaign of education, trying to encourage sportsmen to not use it voluntarily.
Gary?
Another reason that they phased it in, not only for the fishermen, but for the people who sell this stuff, they had all this stuff, supplies in hand.
Lots of inventory.
And so they gave them 2 years, basically, to sell off their inventory. And, I mean, it's not only the cost to the fishermen, it's the cost to the businesses as well, which is why they gave them such a long lead time.
One more story that we absolutely should talk about briefly, Sam, and that is milfoil. As the summer tourism season begins, a lot of people take their boats out on the lakes, and the state's Lake Host program is, getting ready to greet them. Now, just remind us, what is milfoil? How big a problem is it?
So variable milfoil is an invasive aquatic weed. It's part of the reason why it's a big problem is just incredibly hard to get rid of. If you take it's like a worm in that if you take a vine, we'll call it, of milfoil and break it in half, it's got roots all up and down the whole length of it. And so you've just essentially created two plants by breaking it in half. So you really have to get every single last bit of it if you want to extinguish it from a lake. However, the reason that it's a problem is because it's unsightly. It takes lakes that have been nice places to swim and turns them into weedy, soupy messes. And so homeowners on lakes really don't like this new plant. But it's incredibly aggressive. It's really hard to get rid of. So it's been a problem. I actually believe, though, that this year – so the Lake Host program got kicked off on they were sent out to the boat ramps on Memorial Day. Their job is basically to stand there, and every boat that comes in, they check it for milfoil to make sure there's nothing on there, and they call that a save. If you find that there was milfoil on a boat and you pull it off, you've saved that lake. And what I'm hearing is actually that the lake hosts have been making fewer saves in recent years, and that's sort of an indication that the problem is sort of getting under control, that the towns have been successful in reducing the quantity, in educating boat owners so that they're cleaning off their boats. I was actually hearing, in fact, my mother-in-law is a big milfoil battler, and I was hearing from her that they, you know, they were worried about the early ice out this year, and they thought that meant the milfoil would go crazy, but they were out looking at the lake and they didn't see that much out there. So they're feeling pretty optimistic.
Okay. Well, somebody needs to figure out some use for milfoil, given its, its ability to grow.
Compost.
Compost, fuel. I mean, could we, fuel cars with milfoil? I'll leave that for you, Sam, to investigate as you work on your environment stories and outside in. Somebody needs to find something useful to do with milfoil. Thank you so much
for being here. Thank you for having me on. See ya.
That's NHPR's environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown, also host of our new show, Outside In. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and you can join us with your questions and comments as we cover the top stories around the state, 1-800-892-6477. Gary and Dean, I did want to turn to another story that we have covered periodically here on the Roundup, and this made a huge headline here in Concord, Dean. It's got reverberations around New England that has a large number of private boarding schools in this region. This week, a lawsuit was filed against the prestigious St. Paul's School in Concord. This relates to a high-profile case of sexual assault on the campus. We've talked about this a lot, but can you just sketch us a quick outline, please, Dean, of what this suit says?
Sure. This suit is filed by the family of the girl involved in this case. They filed it anonymously, I believe, as John and Jane Doe to protect the identity of the girl because she's a minor. And they're basically arguing that the school has fostered a culture in which this kind of thing can happen, with this that sort of kind of a culture of kind of sexual assault and male aggressiveness, et cetera. The suit claims that St. Paul's has been aware of this senior salute contest that boys on campus engage in, and that they basically did not adequately protect the family's daughter.
Yeah, and I read the Concord Monitor's coverage of it, which was quite
extensive coverage, yes.
And some of the language that was used, Dean, is really kind of damning. You know, not just saying, how did this happen, but this was part of a broader, pervasive
right.
culture. And of course, the school says, no. And
yeah, they categorically deny all of it. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But I don't think this is a great surprise to anyone that the family would do this. I think this was expected. I've heard some legal analysts even suggest that the LaBrie family may sue as well, to say that, you know, their son was not sort of, that the school kind of dropped the ball on this, that their son was not in an environment that he should have been in, et cetera. We'll see. I don't know if they will, but I'm not surprised to see this filed.
Well, and this has, of course, this whole incident, Gary, has set off a lot of self-reflection at sure. prep schools around New England. I mean, this is not just a St. Paul's issue.
No, I mean, we see the issues down at Exeter, at Phillips Exeter, and there was another school down in Rhode Island. I mean, this is very...
St. George's.
I mean, this has been a lot, and it's gotten a lot of publicity recently. So I'm sure that all these schools are trying to address this as best they can at this point.
Well, one other quick thing on St. Paul's, and now I recall that there had been an external review, and the review had suggested that the campus culture was too permissive, there was not enough oversight, that there's kind of this sort of imbalance between sort of idealism and supervision, and that was something that they had been warned of, but that they had not addressed.
Oh, so idealism in that, Dean, you want to be independent and, you know, make your own choices,
right, exactly.
But the accusation
there wasn't
is that it was too much.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Well, one more story, guys. Speaking of publicity, this week, Manchester's police chief Nick Willard decided not to allow the reality TV show Cops to film in the city. Now, I was not familiar with this show, but for those like me who are not familiar with what this show is, here's just a little short clip to give you an idea of what the show is like.
I just got my license, sir.
Okay. What I want you to do, I see the drugs you have in your hand.
Don't
drop nothing. Put your hands where I can see it.
Okay, so that's just a little sampling of the reality TV show Cops. Have either of you guys watched this show? Dean?
Sure. It's been around for many, many years. It really is one of the earliest reality TV shows, and you can't play a clip without playing that theme song, which a lot of people know. And it's basically, you follow the cops in a particular city on their patrols overnights, dealing with domestic disputes and drug busts and other kinds of crime. And, you know, while it gives you a real bird's eye view of law enforcement, you know, some people who don't like the show believe it kind of gives you an unbalanced view, sort of a negative view of the city, because you're seeing crime and drug abuse and those kinds of things. And so I guess they originally were going to participate, and then there was some people protested, and the chief decided on second thought, we're not going to do this. But it's been around for a long, long time.
Okay, I don't know how I missed out on that. But Gary, so why did Manchester sort of say, yes, let's do it, and then no, maybe we shouldn't?
Well, I think Yes is, you know, it's a reality TV show and people really like to participate in these sort of things. And it's good. I mean, to some extent, it's good publicity. But I think the other side is it's bad publicity for a city, and some of the business community and some of the residents were saying to the police, I don't think this has been kind of a tough time here in the city. We've had a couple of tough weeks.
There have been a couple tough weeks in Manchester, you know, lockdowns and shootings of police officers. And
so I think the clearer heads prevailed. But we don't have to, you know, we don't have to think that law enforcement isn't being represented on reality TV shows because the Fish and Game Commission officers are being part of a program much like what they call Maine Wild. They started filming this year, so.
Okay, and we will look forward to seeing that. Well, we've got a couple of Facebook comments on this decision to do the show and then not do the show. Gwen says, thank goodness, it was a very poor idea. Christopher says, what image are businesses and residents trying to protect? He says, Manchester is disgusting. Wow, Christopher. I've lived in some rough towns in my life, and I wouldn't go to downtown Manchester ever. I moved here to get away from sketchy people and areas, but I ended up moving into a worse environment. Christopher says, by the way, the law enforcement personnel are doing an incredible job keeping the peace and keeping the lid on a highly volatile area, but it's just getting worse. They need help. Thanks for those Facebook comments. Gentlemen, I always like to end the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup by finding out what you're going to be covering next week. So, Gary, the State House is done. What are you going to do?
Sort of almost done. The never-ending
rattle around
session.
The halls by yourself.
I would, except there are all these candidates filing through the offices.
Right. That continues next week.
We have the Governor Hassan is filing for the U.S. Senate on Monday. At the end of the week, we have all of the gubernatorial candidates lining up to file. They're filing at the last minute so they can take those $5,000 checks until they put the name on the line.
Okay. So state candidates have an advantage to filing late. So we'll be likely catching up on that next week. How about you, Dean? What are you going to be watching?
Obviously, the rest of the filing period. But two stories that caught my eye this week. One is the Republican primary in the second congressional CD. Jim Lawrence, who ran in 2014, getting in to go against Jack Flanagan. A former Republican majority leader of the state House. That's going to be an interesting primary now, and I'm glad to see that there's a little bit of action going on in that district. We've only been talking about District 1. Second story, the Van Ostern campaign for governor challenged other campaigns to show their fundraising numbers in June rather than wait till the end of August, which is right before the primary. We'll see if anybody responds. An interesting challenge from them.
And any Pints and Politics interviews coming up?
More on tap, not ready to announce yet.
On tap, no pun there.
No pun, pun intended.
Thank you both very much for being here. I really appreciate it. Gary and Dean, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.